This is the Bible Show. Welcome, folks, to another episode of the Bible Show. My name is Sam Caston Smith. I'll be your host today. Joining me is Will.
Hello.
And we are jumping into another miracle in the life of Jesus. And today we're going to be talking about him healing a lame man at the Pool of Bethesda. And so, as kind of the introduction that we've been doing in a lot of these episodes, you know, what is a miracle? It's not a suspension of the natural order. Like, that's one of the things that I think was really helpful for me to learn. Like, when God comes into the world, he's already made the world once the way he wanted, right? He made it without the fall. He made it without disease. He made it without death. And so when he comes into the world in human flesh and he begins to create and to work, we should expect him to find, to do and desire the same things that we saw in the first creation. And so it's not a suspension of the way God made things. It's a restoration of the way God made things. And then the next part of this that we talked about in previous episodes is Jesus doesn't do miracles as parlor tricks. He's never like, hey, look at me, isn't this cool? Like, he's always doing it to teach something, to advance the kingdom of God in people's minds, to evangelize, to teach us something. And so whenever we come to a miracle story like today, we should be looking for that. Like, what is it that this story has for me?
Yeah, I think that's helpful when we think about that beforehand every time, because my natural state of reading these is just to focus on the physical actions that are taken or just how that guy's life was impacted. But it is fascinating that even Jesus, I mean, isn't his whole goal to bring the kingdom of heaven down to earth? And he's kind of even giving a picture of that.
Yeah, I mean, the first way he's introduced, you know, it's John the Baptist out in the wilderness. And what is he saying? Behold, you know, the kingdom of heaven is at hand. The kingdom of heaven has come down in the person of Jesus, which means he's kind of like heaven personified. He's everything about heaven, you know, God himself in a person. And that's the essence of heaven, is God. And so here he comes, he's at hand, and with him, it's like, you know, imagine, you know, the cartoons you see where somebody's walking along and behind them life is emerging and the flowers are coming up and the birds are chirping and everything else. Like, not to that degree, but that's kind of like what he's doing. He's bringing heaven to bear on this earth. And when he gives his church a mission, what is it? You know, we can't, you know, raise the dead to life in our own power. But what does he tell us? He says that we are to make heaven, or we're to make the earth as it is in heaven, right? So we're bringing about the ethics of the kingdom, the nature of the kingdom, love and patience and the fruit of the spirit and all of that. We're trying to bring heaven down to invade a broken and fallen earth. We may not have the same miraculous power Jesus did, but in what we can do, that's our mission.
Yeah.
It's the same. We're bringing heaven to the earth. And so this story, we're starting in John chapter 5, and it says this, and there after this, so Jesus has just done a different miracle at the end of John chapter 4. It says, after this, there was a feast of the Jews. And Jesus went up from Jerusalem. Now, it doesn't tell us what feast this is.
Okay.
But we know that there are three feasts, according to Deuteronomy, where every Jew, no matter where they lived, were supposed to come back to Jerusalem, to the place where God dwells, and then they would celebrate the festival. And, I mean, you had a lot of different feasts, but the three primary ones included Passover and Pentecost and the Feast of Booths. But outside of that, you had Yom Kippur and you had Rosh Hashanah and you had all these other feasts. And so it doesn't tell us which one this is.
Okay.
And one of the reasons that, you know, commentators wish they knew which feast it was is we know how long Jesus carried on his ministry based on the number of Passovers that he goes through in the Gospel of John.
Huh.
And so have you ever heard how long was Jesus's ministry?
3 years.
Where do you find that verse?
Just because people told me that.
Right? That's how everybody is. But the how we come up with that is as you go through the Gospel of John, you'll go, oh, and the time for Passover came and Jesus went to Jerusalem. And then there's another Passover. And then there's another Passover on which he's crucified. And so you're like, okay, well, it had to be
three annual feasts.
That's right. And so if this is another Passover, it's possible that we're wrong.
Whoa.
And that he could have been in active ministry even longer. So we don't know that. I'm pretty sure there's nothing else that points to that. So it's kind of interesting to think about. Jesus is in Jerusalem for a feast. And so that means by the way, what's going on? If he's there for the feast, guess what?
Everybody else is.
Everybody else is. Yeah. And they say that Jerusalem, when you would have like the Feast of Passover or Pentecost, a big deal, that Jerusalem would swell up to many times its normal population. And people would be camping out on the hillsides and in the surrounding towns. Like Jesus has people in Bethany, Martha and Mary and Lazarus, which is over the hill of the Mount of Olives on the other side. Like he's staying there. Everybody, you know, all the bed and breakfast
filled.
Everything's filled up, which means there's going to be a big audience for this. And you know, when they would have these religious feasts, another thing that we need to get into our mind is it's like, you know, we have church every week.
Yeah.
But when Christmas and Easter comes,
it's a big deal.
It's at another level. We bring out the fine china and we got the deacons doing stuff. We want to make sure that it's the best possible foot forward. So now all the Jews, all the religious leaders, when I say Jews, when John says Jews, he means the leaders.
Okay.
They're on their game. They are monitoring everything to make sure that everything's in line. They're dotting their I's and crossing their T's and making sure that everybody's obeying the law and that this is going well because it's a high holy season. And so it says, now there is in Jerusalem by the sheep gate a pool, in Aramaic called Bethesda, which has five roofed colonnades. Now you and I have been to this place. Do you remember being there?
Yes.
Vaguely?
Well, it's different because it's not an active pool now, so it looks correct. Like just a rock hole in the ground. So why don't they put water in it?
I don't know. I don't know that it would hold it. Like, I think all the stuff in the bottom has been cracked. But one of the things that's interesting is when they uncovered this, you know, the fact that it says five roofed colonnades, that is really interesting because when you go there, you see these, you know, arched colonnades. One of them is still intact. The other ones, you just see the foundational stones that come up, and it's pretty deep, like it's tall. So you can imagine this would have been pretty impressive, like a pool. This would have been high-end, pretty impressive structure, but you can still see it. You can count out the roofed colonnades, at least the foundations of them, that are still there to this day. And even in, and it says in Aramaic there that it's called Bethesda, and the reason why that's important is it's the house of mercy is what that translates to. So anytime you see Beth and a Hebrew name like Bethlehem, Bethel, like there, it always means the house or the place of, and that this is the house of mercy, which is going to be like, it would have been known as that because
of what's about to,
of what the tradition was that takes place here. This is where people go for healing, and it's why a lot of hospitals are called Bethesda or Bethesda Memorial. You'll find that a lot. So anyway, all that's going on, and it says in verse 3, in these lay a multitude of invalids, blind, lame, and paralyzed. And so then, if you notice in your Bible, we're using the ESV, it skips from verse 3. What's the next verse? Go ahead and read verse 4 for me, Will.
Oh, man, I can't.
Why not?
It's not there.
Because verse 4 is not there. Now, this is one of the very few places in Scripture where you'll find that there is debate over whether or not the manuscripts have a verse that's there. And it actually makes doing commentary on this passage a lot easier because the verse that's taken out that's not in some of the earliest manuscripts, so people think that it was added in for like, because if you read this, why are all these people laying around there? Why are they all coming to this pool?
Yeah, why was it the house of mercy?
Right. So in the Gospel of John, a lot of people in the early church, this is what people believe happened, that John's like, hey, there's a whole bunch of people laying here, invalids and blind people and lame people and paralyzed people, and they're laying here. And he just goes straight on with the story and never answers the question, why are they coming there? And so they believe that one of the scribes early on said, okay, let me explain why they were there. And then this is what verse 4 would be. For an angel of the Lord went down at certain seasons into the pool and stirred the water. Whoever stepped in first after the stirring of the water was healed of whatever disease he had.
That changes things.
Doesn't it? Because when you read that, if you read that as, okay, that's officially in the Bible, which it might be. Manuscripts, early manuscripts, some have it, some don't. And usually that means that there's either an addition to add context, text, and usually that means it probably wasn't there, if it's just trying to clarify something. And then other times, like John 8, I think it was taken away because the mercy was too, like John 8 is where it talks about Jesus with a woman who is caught in adultery. And he says, you know, let he who has no sin cast the first stone, and he lets her go. Like the early church was scandalized by that kind of mercy. And so some of the early manuscripts don't have John 8, the beginning of it, and it with that story. And people believe that the early church fathers took it out because they didn't want to encourage, you know, adultery without consequences.
What a funny
thought. Crazy. But there's not a lot of that. But in this one, with context, it's making it sound like for sure an angel of the Lord goes down there, stirs up the water, and anyone who goes first into the water gets healed. Hmm. Well, what do you think? You think that's in the, should that be in there or not? Or are you just, I have no idea.
I don't know, but I'm very trustworthy of the ESV guys.
Yeah.
And the NIV doesn't have it either. I just looked that up.
So everybody acknowledges that there's manuscript evidence. And that's one of the reasons why you can trust your Bible, is they're not throwing this at you being like, haha, you know, they'll never know. All of your Bibles are going to have notations. Like if you notice in the ESV right after the word, you know, it says there were a bunch of invalids there, blind, lame, and paralyzed. There's a notation number 3. And when you go to the bottom of the page, you'll see the note, right?
Yeah.
Where it lists the verse that's supposed to be there. And it will tell you some manuscripts have this and some don't. Well, but it's also very helpful because it tells us what they believed at the time. Okay, so now it makes sense that, okay, at this pool, you get all of these people that have conditions and sicknesses and blindness and lame, paralyzed, that go there because there was a belief that at certain seasons, and notice that, it's not every day. So like when the holy season comes, maybe the angel will be here and we're in the middle of one of these great celebrations and feasts. So everybody run to Bethesda.
Which is why they kind of lived there, it seems like, because mm-hmm. they don't know when the angel of the Lord's going to show up. So we kind of got to like.
Yeah, and especially hop in for the high holy days. So now it's like, it's packed, it's crowded here. And they're waiting for this idea of, you know, the angel's going to stir the waters and the first one to touch it is going to be healed, which to us sounds really, really crazy. But when you go through the Bible, there are other instances where crazy happens, you know, and so there's a list of these in one of the commentaries that I use. And it was like in 2 Kings 4, some people are healed by a purified pot of stew. Mm. Oh, that's weird. Like, okay, why? Like you have to get into that one. Naaman is healed specifically by washing, not just washing in the Jordan River, but doing it 7 times. So there's no scientific formula that makes sense of that. So it's like, okay, there's a bizarre thing that's happening where God, Elijah saying, hey, go do this and you'll be healed, or Elisha. And one boy's healed by touching the bones of Elisha. Some are healed in the New Testament when Peter's shadow falls on them. And then there's another one where Paul's handkerchief would heal people when it was laid on them. And so, like, this is happening in the Scriptures. It's happening in the New Testament. And so the idea to these people that an angel stirs up the water and the first one that gets there gets the healing power of it. I mean, I could understand, given the rest of Scripture, okay, sometimes God uses things like this that are kooky to us to heal people, and so it draws huge crowds, which then also begs the question, something had to have happened to start.
Somebody had to get healed once.
That's right. There had to have been. People just don't start going, everyone go to the pools of Bethesda. Amazing things happen here if there's nobody who has ever been healed.
Also, I mean, that's a desperate group of people. Mm-hmm. So you have to assume even a glimmer of hope. If I can't walk for 38 years, I'm going to sit there for a while.
Yeah. I mean, where else are you going to go?
I mean, sitting somewhere, so.
Right. So it may as well be with some level of hope. And the other part of this that you got to think about is if all these people are coming lame and paralyzed, that means that people are bringing them there. Mm. So in the ancient world, particularly in the Near East, like if you were paralyzed, your family would take you to busy intersections or places of commerce, and then they would lay you down and you would stay there the whole day. And your job, you couldn't go farm, you couldn't plant, you couldn't plow. Your job, your full-time job was to beg. And so whenever one of these feasts would come along, then it's everybody's going to the pools of Bethesda. Mm-hmm. Everybody's going there. So just an interesting note for verse 4. It's not in the Bible.
It's not there.
So verse 5, it says, one man was there who had been an invalid for 38 years.
Can you fully define invalid for me?
So I'm thinking he's unable to walk. He's at least paralyzed from the waist down in my imagination.
Okay.
Because when Jesus says later, when he heals him, he says, take up your bed and walk. It's surprising that he can walk.
Okay.
And so he's got a disability that keeps him from being able to move. And so invalid is, that's basically what it means.
Okay.
Crippled, handicapped, something that's an equivalent word, a synonym. So verse 6, you got to think, 38 years. What kind of thoughts do you think run through your head that after 38 years, you're still showing up?
That's astounding to me, actually.
Right?
I mean, hope is an interesting thing.
And you can tell as the story goes, you'll see how surprised he is and that I don't know that he really believes like we expect him to believe. And this guy's got a strange story, as we'll see. But after 38 years, he's still showing up, and yet he doesn't quite get it. He doesn't quite believe it. He doesn't quite expect it. And I think, you know, we would say 38 years to keep showing up. I think we do this a lot to where it's like we show up to church for 38 years every Sunday, and we can still do the faithful thing and come and say, you know, I need this without expecting God to do the big thing. Does that make sense? Like, yeah. You show up for 38 years, and eventually it just gets to be like, you know, because this is what we do. But I'm not showing up at church. You know, my heart's grown bitter. My heart's done this. I'm walking through grief. I feel, you know, tension with God. I'm bitter toward how my life has turned out. And I go to church for 38 years. But after a while, it's like, you know, it's just, this is what we do. Mm. I'm not expecting anything. I'm not expecting God to move. And there's part of it where you could look at it and say, wow, 38 years, you must really believe and you've never given up hope, or
just what he does.
Yeah, this has become just kind of my thing. To us, I think for me, you know, I've been a believer now 24 years now, came to faith in my early 20s. And I remember in those early days of faith, every time I showed up at church, it was like excitement. Like, what is God going to do?
Expectancy.
You know, like, is this worship going to be powerful? Is it going to change my perspective on something? Am I going to find something else new about God that's going to blow my mind and change my life? And then a year goes by, and then I'm showing up, and I'm enjoying church, and it's good. And 20 years go by, and seminary goes by, and you just start getting used to it. And then you start not expecting God to revolutionize your heart every week. Mm. And you start expecting God not to do the healing because, you know what, I've come for 38 years. And yeah, you know, it was cool to have that bright flash of hope 38 years ago when I first started doing this. But in 38 years, I haven't been healed. Mm. 38 years, he hasn't shown up. 38 years, I haven't been able to get to the water first. So now it's just kind of something I do, but I'm not expecting it. And you can imagine this guy kind of building into that cynicism, like that would be inevitable for a human, right? Mm-hmm. Can you relate to that?
Yeah, I was even thinking about it as you were talking, even just with prayer. Mm-hmm. I mean, prayer is, it costs me nothing. I mean, I guess the time that I'm praying, but that's not like, I'm not having to go anywhere. I'm not like this guy who's having to do this. I mean, it would be quite the task to get there every day. I would have to call on other people and get them there. But for me, prayer, I'm just thinking, man, I think we all have, I mean, probably more than one, but all of us have at least one big prayer request that we're still waiting on God to answer. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's probably way more than one, but I can quickly think of one off the top of my mind for me. And I was just thinking how little I've prayed for that.
Mm-hmm. Why not? Because I'm gonna challenge something you said. You know, it doesn't cost you anything. Yeah, it doesn't cost you anything. You don't have to, like, atone and, you know, do some great work.
Oh, yeah, I was just talking about physical cost.
There's no physical cost, but there is an emotional one.
Yeah, and that's probably just getting deeper than I desired it to be. Not even emotional, like, are you saying, like, you're burdened because God hasn't answered?
I'm saying that every time you open up in prayer, you're risking disappointment again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this guy shows up at the pool again for the Lord, literally, the Lord only knows how many times and how many feasts and how many days over 38 years. And every time he says, hey, guys, can you carry me down to the pool again today? Somebody's got to be, you know, made inconvenient. He's got to make that, you know, begging. And then on the way, like, all right, God, please today. Like, how about today? And eventually, like, you get so used to the disappointment of God's answer being no or not yet that I don't want to offer up the prayer because I don't want to have to make sense of why you're saying not yet, because it hurts.
Yeah.
I think in that sense, being vulnerable in front of God and recognizing, by the way, that it was God's decision to have him wait 38 years.
Yeah.
God's not wrong. God's incredibly merciful and beautiful. But every time he offers up that prayer for those 38 years, when the answer was no or not yet, there's a stinging disappointment. And what I want to say is, over the course of 38 years, every time he's disappointed, it becomes less and less painful because his heart inevitably had to have developed a scab over it. It's not tender anymore. Like, I'm not going to make myself vulnerable because I expect you not to answer this because I've made this prayer so many times. And that's where people can make the mistake that's really, really hard not to do, which is to say, you know what? Like, I've done it enough. I quit. It took this guy 38 years, and yet Jesus showed up. His prayer did get answered.
Do you think part of our trouble is the spiritual nature of prayer, not the physical? Well, let me bake that out. Like, this guy went to a physical pool because they believed this is the spot. Mm-hmm. Let's say we had a rock in Fort Lauderdale that when you were touching it, it healed you. Or maybe someone was healed there once, but we all know that, hey, it's this rock alone. A big boulder, let's say. Do you think you would be more tempted, it's a bad word, would you desire to drive to that rock more than you would to pray for that thing?
100%. For sure. I think there's something in human nature that's like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the Catholic relics. I mean, you see that, and if I can only go touch the Holy Lance, you know, or you know, this relic that they say came from the bones of so-and-so saint, this whatever. We see that in human nature, that people go on pilgrimages to touch something that once belonged to the apostles or somebody from the Old Testament. So that is for sure. And I think, you know, you can make an idol of that and be like, okay, it's this cloth that heals. And you see that in the Old Testament with the bronze serpent, right? That ultimately has to be destroyed because people were looking to it rather than God. And I think there's something in me that recognizes that in myself. Like, I want that. So there's a place where Laura and I used to go on vacation a lot. And when I was a brand new believer, we would go there all the time. And it's a house that my dad owns and my brothers. And it's on a lake and it's in a podunk town and just super peaceful. When I go there, there's something in my mind that looks back at all the things that God has done at this place for me before. I get super inspired to write. I feel intimacy with God. This is where, like, I want to listen to worship music when I go there because this is where God shows up when I go to this place. And so there's something in me that same kind of vein where it's like, you know, it's not the rock, but it's that place. He has proven himself there before. And in my mind, I start thinking, like, I need to get there to have an encounter with God. You know, it's places 300 miles away in North Florida. I don't need to go there to have an encounter with God. And yet there's something in me that's like, well, no, that place was cool. And by the way, in the Bible, you see that.
Yeah, I think that's good. That's kind of biblical and unbiblical.
Right. Like, if you're thinking it's the place, no.
If the only place.
Right. Like, oh, I can't have a relationship with God unless I get to Interlock in Florida. No. But God does. Like, when Elijah's having his utter meltdown, God takes him to Mount Sinai. Why? Why does he need to go there? Like, because God, that's where God meets with his prophets.
And that's what, I mean, the patriarchs did that all the time. God met with me here. I built an altar.
Yeah. I'm coming back.
Where God meets me.
So I think we need to have on that point, yes, if there's a rock, I want to go to the rock. But we fall into the stupidity of human idolatry and everything else when we're like, oh, the rock, that's what I need. No, you need the God of the rock.
And I think the rock then convicts me because that means I doubt prayer is actually powerful. Mm-hmm. That's, I mean, 100%. My bottom line is that, like, that's the discrepancy in my soul.
So what do you mean by that? That reveals that you don't trust in prayer. Explain.
I think that.
Or that you struggle with it.
Yeah, that I struggle with it. I believe in prayer, but.
Yeah, everyone.
I would be more tempted. Okay, my thing is narcolepsy. That's what I should be praying more, because that's a huge thing in my life. And if there's one thing that I would like God to take away, it's that. And then I think I struggle with it every night, and I don't pray for it every night. I'm sitting there wide awake at night, and I don't pray for it. I don't go down to the prayer team for that every Sunday at church. But if you told me, hey, well, you have a chance to jump in a pool, I think I would really be tempted to go to that pool often.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be going out of my way to do that. Where God just like, no, I hear you when you pray. Prayer's the most impactful thing you could do in this world. And still, I like the...
Mm-hmm. Let me
the
have
physical
a roll
nature, yeah, yeah. Like hold something, feel something. And it's not that I do that. It's just that would be more.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, this is way off. We're on a rabbit trail that's gone way off the rails here, and I like it. And I think that there's a part of prayer where that's okay. Mm-hmm. As long as it doesn't become, you know, the pool, the rock. You know, when God tells us to pray, he tells us to sometimes to get down on our face.
Yeah.
Why? Like, you're acting out the posture of your heart, or to raise your hands, or to sing, or whatever. Like, this is not essential for prayer. And yet, what does it do? It puts your mind in a place where you're going, you know what? Like, I have this thing here. I'm offering it up to you, or here, I'm receptive to receiving it, like your body is acting it out. And I think there is something that, by that same vein, as long as it doesn't become idolatry, is, hey, I'm getting in a car and I'm driving 300 miles because this is really important to me, and I'm invested in spending time with God. And now the posture of my entire being is, you know, it's not just like, okay, I'm going to drop to my knees right where I'm at, which is fine, and it's good and you should, but it's like, hey, this is really important. I'm doing something that's out of my comfort zone, that's different than everything I've ever done, because I want my heart in a different posture when I engage it. And so if it's going to the pool, whatever, if it's you acting out like, hey, this is serious to me, and I'm really invested in it, so I'm going to do something. I'm going to act this out as some kind of a pilgrimage so that my heart gets more and more intense in prayer. It's the same reason why we fast, right? Yeah. What does fasting do? It's just constantly like, oh, I want that. Oh, I can't have coffee today. That reminds me to pray. Like, I'm giving this up for you, Lord, and I want you in my mind more. It's you're doing something that pulls your heart and focus more toward God. So if it's that, great. If it's the pool is going to heal me, probably not great.
Yeah, that's idolatry. Those places where we say God shows up here, but really it's those places oftentimes for me that, oh no, I just show up actually.
Yeah.
It's right. Like my desire actually to meet with the Lord is real and tangible and excited.
And in this story, you got to imagine, what's he thinking as he's laying there?
Is today the day?
You think?
I'm more hopeful about this guy than you are.
Yeah.
In his tone.
Well, this guy ends on a bad note, so I'm already like, I'm jaded against him. Or at least I think he ends on a bad note. It says, when Jesus saw him lying there, which is just cool. That's all it took. Like, this guy does nothing. He's an invalid. He's lame. He can't do anything. But Jesus saw him. And that's all it takes. And that's, I think what we need to recognize is Jesus has seen all of us already, no matter where we're at, no matter whether our prayers have been answered. But that's it. Like, all I need is to be in the presence of Jesus within his sight, and I know that I am. And it says, when Jesus saw him lying there, and he knew that he had already been there a long time, he said to him, do you want to be healed? Like, the fact that
Jesus does this all the time.
But the fact that he asks him that is mind-boggling, right? But it also means, like, Jesus doesn't just ask, you know, dumb questions. Because this, from the outside, it's like, let's look at the evidence, Jesus. He asked his friends to put him on a mat and to carry him down into a pool where there's healing. Like, do you think he wants it? This feels like a duh question, but it's a profound question. Do you want to be healed?
Yeah, because he's inviting personal introspection, right?
Yeah. I mean, okay. think about this. Like, how many times in pastoral counseling do you find somebody who comes to you and they're in the aftermath of devastating sin and their marriage is imploding and, you know, what they want is a quick remedy.
Yeah. They want to rewind.
Yeah. They want you to sprinkle some dust on them and be like, oh, your marriage is fine because, you know, Jesus. And the reality is, like, when you give counsel, it's like, okay, well, let me tell you how to be healed. It means this. It means that you need to put your trust in Christ. It means you need to die to your selfish impulses. It means you need to humble yourself and you need to do this. And like, you're going to die, but this means that you have to yield to Jesus.
Yeah.
Do you want that? And then all of a sudden, because then you can say, this is what that looks like if you want that. And the moment you start saying, hey, this is what it costs you. You've got to get rid of your pride and you've got to die to yourself and take up your cross and crucify the flesh and da da da. Are you willing to do that? Because if you want to sit down with your wife, like, I'm totally happy to do that and we can do this together. And then it's all of a sudden the pride comes and it's like, well, she da da da. And it's like, okay, so you really don't want this. Mm. You just want to win.
Yeah.
Let's get down to it. Like, you're not eager to submit to Christ or surrender to Christ or do any of that for the sake of what's bringing destruction in your marriage. You're unwilling to do what Jesus calls you to do to bring about a resurrection to your marriage. So do you really want this? Or are you just here to gripe about how painful your situation is? And so often people don't want to be healed. And they express that because they're unwilling to do what God calls them to do, to be healed. Oof. And that's where I'm like, okay, this guy's been here for 38 years. Is he just doing this because it's what he does? Does he still believe in a God who heals? Is he still willing to give all of his hope and all of his faith to a God who heals? And I think when Jesus comes and asks this question, it's not the, oh, do you want to be healed? Like the guy's going to say, no, I'm good. Yeah. It's, hey, man, deep down in your heart, do you want this? Because let me tell you what salvation and rescue means. It's not just, hey, here, you know, everything's great for you. Now go live however you want. Like, if I'm coming to you and I'm bringing salvation and rescue to you, it's going to change your life. You want that? I mean, that was the reason why I stayed away from Jesus for so long. I knew that everything that was offered in the gospel sounded amazing to me.
Yeah.
But it meant also that he was going to come in and turn over all the junk in my life. Mm. And it was like, maybe next week, you know, I'm not sure I'm ready to change. And I kept him at arm's length because of that, which is stupid. You know, I admittedly was very stupid, but I think that's kind of the heart of this question.
And is that why life is so complex? Because even we're talking about this, like, introspection is necessary for all of us, because at certain times in life, just showing up without a really like an ecstatic belief in something mm-hmm. is awesome. But then other times it's draining and kind of fake mm-hmm. to where you like allow yourself to go into neutral. So that's why introspection's an interesting.
Yeah, neutral is so easy. I think it's like we're naturally sinners, but mm-hmm. then we're also naturally skeptic. And when we get no for 38 years, it's so easy to be like, you know what? Like, yeah, I mean,
true.
I come to church, but I don't expect big things anymore. I don't expect to be blown away by God's love. I don't expect to be reduced to tears like it used to. Like, and we harden. We become hardened. And it's like, I think that's where Jesus comes and says, like, how badly do you want that again?
Yeah.
Do you really want to be healed? Because you come with a heart that is stone sometimes. And I could be wrong, but that's the way I read into this question. So the sick man answered him, sir, I have no one here to put me into the pool when the water stirred up. And while I'm going, another one steps down before me. So, I mean, that affirms what the missing verse 4 says. Like, he believes that the first one to get down to the pool is going to be healed, but there's a race and nobody is selfless enough to skip their prayer request.
That'd be tough.
To put this guy down there first. And so, but where are his eyes?
It's, on the pool.
Yeah, the pool. Like, here, God is talking to him. He doesn't know this. But God is talking to him.
Yeah, I would still be the character in Scripture who's like talking to Jesus, having no idea.
Yeah, like, can you believe what God did?
Yeah.
You know.
Someone put me in the pool.
I mean, but in reality, like, again, he's got his eyes on the pool when God is right in front of him. And so that's another call. Take your eyes off the pool.
Wouldn't you just keep your foot in the pool?
That's a good question.
Why is no one just dipping, having a hand in the pool the whole time?
I have no idea. That's a great question. Yeah, I'd be like, yeah, it would be like fish out of water, you know, playing whatever, Marco Polo. Like, I'm keeping my toe
in. Put my toe in there.
Just
yeah.
in case. Anyway, he says, I have no one to put me, I guess a paralyzed guy, like, would want to be in the pool.
Yeah, you don't want to be floating in the pool, but if it's just.
Maybe just lay his leg in there. So anyway, I'm not sure what the question is, or if there was some kind of tradition where it's like, all right, everybody stand
aside.
There
was a referee.
Or maybe they weren't allowed to go into the pool. Maybe these were cleansing pools. I'm not sure. So verse 8, it says, Jesus said to him, and this is where it gets wild, get up, which the word there is arise. It's a word of resurrection, which very deliberate. Arise, take up your bed, and walk.
Yes.
And at once, the man was healed. And he took up his bed and walked. Now, this is, if you're coming at this from like a materialistic perspective, right? There's problems. Because even if something was triggered in the spine that, you know, synapses finally connected and it was just a natural way of this happening, what's the problem if this guy hasn't walked for 38 years?
Atrophy.
There's no way. There's no way this guy has the strength, even if the spine suddenly started communicating to the legs again.
Yeah, there's no muscles.
Yeah, your muscles are toast. Like, you'd have to be in physical therapy for who knows how long to regain the ability to walk. And what does it say? At
once,
the man was healed, and he took up his bed and walked, which means God not only healed what was keeping his brain from communicating with his legs, but God restored everything that had been lost over those 38 years. He restored all the muscle that was never there or that had atrophied away, everything. It wasn't just healing to a neutral place. It was restoring to healthy. That is a powerful miracle that would have been utterly inexplicable to everybody who had been seeing this guy come back and forth to this pool for 38 years. And now the crowds are all around. Everybody's witnessing this. And what's the nature of what just happened? When you're paralyzed or you're lame and you're lying on a mat, your body is essentially
dead.
And what was Jesus's word?
Arise.
Arise. This is a God who works resurrection miracles. And that's what these people are saying. And now if the story ended there, amazing.
Great.
You got to wonder, like, this guy, 38 years, he's still like, you know, he clearly doesn't have huge expectations to me. And now Jesus just comes and blows his socks off and he's up and walking. And it says, and then in the end of that verse, it says, now the day was the Sabbath. Okay. Why is that a big deal?
Because it turns out you're not supposed to do things like this on the Sabbath.
And yes.
In the eyes of the Pharisees.
That's correct. So if you were to get in a time machine and you go back to first century Israel, they took the Sabbath like ridiculously seriously. Mm. So Of course, the Ten Commandments, we walked through this in our Ten Commandments series, which if you haven't seen that or heard that, go back and listen to Commandment number 4, because it's powerful. God comes and he says, hey, you are to keep the Sabbath holy. You're to honor God. You're not to do any work on it on the Sabbath. But what was the whole point of why God said that?
To worship.
Yeah, to worship. And by the way, your identity is not in what you do. It's not in what you produce. It's not like work, 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 because only what I produce, that's what I'm valuable. God comes and says, no, stop. You're valuable because you spend time with me. That's where what I want you to do on the Sabbath. Do not work. Your identity is not work. Your identity is in me, so come to me. It was about restoring humanity and giving them dignity and giving them rest and rejuvenation and all of that stuff. And what happened was, the early Jews that looked at this and previous generations had gotten so ungodly, like the generations of the kings were so ungodly, that by the time you came to Jesus's generation, you had these people with the best of intentions that were like, the people of God always walk away from him. We always do the wicked thing. So we're not only going to just keep the Sabbath law.
Yeah.
Oh, we're going to build circles around it to make sure no one gets close to breaking the Sabbath law. So you're not allowed to tie knots. You're not allowed to untie knots. You're not allowed to make a fire. You're not allowed to put out a fire. You're not allowed to write. You're not allowed to sow. You're not allowed to do all kinds of things. And one of the laws, I think there were 39 of them that they came up with that they wrote, like, to put boundaries all around the Sabbath, made it so like suffocating and constricting that they sat around and went like, I don't know. Am I allowed to do this? Like, what should I do? I can't do anything because I'm just going to sit, you know, like even to this day, you know. And I sent you an article last night I came across that in 1992 in this little suburb of Tel Aviv, there was an ultra-Orthodox Jewish community. And the guy's house caught on fire, his apartment. And he thought, I'm not allowed to use the phone because even using electricity at all is a violation of the Sabbath on the Sabbath. So like if you live in a community with ultra-Orthodox Jewish people, they will wait at the elevator for someone else to press the button. Mm. They will ask their neighbors to come turn the lights on because they're not allowed to use electricity. So this guy with his apartment on fire goes and finds the rabbi and is like, am I allowed to call the fire department? 30 minutes after the two apartments on either side of him have burned down because he was so afraid of working on the Sabbath, which is like, I mean, just think how crazy that is. Like the amount of work that you had to do and all the emotional energy that you expended and the consequences to your neighbors of being this legalistic about the Sabbath is absurd, right? Like that's just, it sounds dumb and it is dumb. But in this story, the reason why this is such a bad thing on the Sabbath, as we'll see, is because they monitored every little behavior and whether or not was that considered work. You better not be working. And in the Sabbath law, if you violated the Sabbath unknowingly, then you had to offer a sacrifice. But if you violated the Sabbath willfully, you were cut off from the community.
Wow.
Okay, so this is a big deal. And now listen, so that with that context, let's see where the story goes. This should be a great day. Everybody should be celebrating this wonderful miracle, right?
Yeah, 38 years in the making.
Amazing. Way to go. Like, this is awesome. Verse 10, so the Jews said to the man who had been healed, it is the Sabbath, and it is not lawful for you to take up your bed, because one of those laws that we were talking about earlier was it was against the Sabbath regulations. This is not biblical. This is, you know, their custom they created. You could not carry items between property lines. So they would say, people were afraid, like if you sewed and you put the needle in your coat because, you know, you fix your robe or whatever, and people would put their needle in the coat in case they needed to sew and fix something later. They would have to like make sure, did I take the needle out? Like if you were going somewhere, like
stressful,
so stressful, such slavery, right? And so it is the Sabbath. It's not lawful for you to take up your bed and cross property lines. Because what did Jesus say? Take up your bed and walk, like go home.
Yeah, get out of here.
Yeah. And he's crossing property lines. So that's a problem for them. And so the guy who's been healed answered them, the man who healed me, that man said, it's not my fault. He said, take up your bed and walk. And so they said, who is this man that said to you, take up your bed and walk? Not, oh my goodness, you're walking.
Yeah, that's wild. That's a wild response.
Oh my goodness. Do you ever feel that kind of suffocating legalism though? Where like you could be doing, we talked about this earlier, so I know the answer is yes. You could be doing something that is so amazing and so fruitful, and somebody comes along and says, yeah, but this. And then they like, dude, the guy was healed. Look at how amazing this is. And you're focusing in on this stupid thing? And there's a scene in, I love this scene because I can relate to it and I'm annoyed by it every bit as much as the movie. But in Christmas Vacation, the Griswolds.
Of course.
You have Clark Griswold out and he's covered his house and Christmas lights, all the decorations, everything. I mean, absurd numbers of Christmas lights, and he's trying, getting frustrated, trying to get the lights on. So finally his wife flicks the power switch and everything lights up and it's beautiful. And it's, you know, the Hallelujah chorus is playing in the movie. And then his father-in-law comes out, and what's his comment? The little lights aren't twinkling, Clark. Here's this glorious moment where the house is glowing and Clark just says, thanks, Art. Thanks for noticing. And that's what this feels like. Like, this guy's walking after 38 years. This house is lit up, brilliant, beautiful, amazing. And what are they focused on? He carried his mat across property line.
And we got to find the guy who did this.
Right? Like, crazy. And it said, verse 13, now the man who had been healed did not know who it was. So Jesus, again, you see his humility here. He's not like, it is me, everybody.
Tell him Jesus Christ.
That's right. Here's my business card. For Jesus had withdrawn, as there was a crowd in the place. Afterward, Jesus found him in the temple and said to him, hey, see, you're well. Sin no more, that nothing worse may happen to you. Now, how do you hear that? When you read that right off the page, what do you think Jesus is communicating there?
That a sin made him that way.
Yeah. Yeah. And by the way, that might be true. You know, he might have been doing something sinful when he got injured. We don't know the background of his story. But what Jesus is saying is, hey, you've spent 38 years wrecked in your life because of this disability. What I'm telling you is go forward and sin, because if you continue in your sin, if you continue in your rebellion, something worse is going to happen to you, right? Death is still coming for you.
Yeah.
There's going to be a day where you stand before God and you're judged and everything else. Like, leave that life of rebellion, or something even worse is coming. And so what Jesus is saying, that then takes this story and applies it to all of us, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because, okay, we might not be able to relate to the paralyzed guy on a mat trying to get to the pool. That's his story. But Jesus is coming and saying, oh, that was the minor thing.
Yeah.
That was just the precursor to what I wanted to talk to you about. Like, yes, I can heal you from not being able to walk. I'm God. But there's something more important that I have to tell you. And so Jesus comes back, circles back again, and says, hey, like, do you see my power to raise you? Stop this rebellion that you have against God, or something worse is going to come upon you. Now we then can enter that, right? Okay, if Jesus is saying, hey, something worse than paralysis is plaguing humanity, and it requires us to say, you know what? Like, I am walking away from my status as a rebel, shaking a fist at God, doing things my way. Jesus is like, now leave that. Leave that. Be done with that. Sin no more, or something worse may happen to you. And so the man went away, and what does he do?
Wait, and unlike...
All right, yeah, go ahead.
And unlike when he heals the paralytic, Jesus doesn't forgive this guy's sin. So the ball's kind of in this guy's court with his relationship to God.
Mm-hmm.
He's kind of saying, hey, this is just a precursor, but take this and go and think about it, which I think is interesting.
Yeah. So what you're left with is like, is this guy a believer?
It doesn't seem like an immediate conversion story to me.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it is.
Yeah.
So he comes. I mean, he wants the blessing of God. He wants the benefit of God. He wants the healing of God. Does he want God? Does he want to surrender to God? Does he want to yield to God? And that's why I think when Jesus comes to him and he says, do you want to be healed?
Yeah.
Now that question even more so. Okay, now you can walk. Now your life is back to normal. It's in your hands. You can do all kinds of things. Do you want to be healed?
Yeah, for more than just...
Yeah, or are you content to just go about your worldly business and ignore God and thumb your nose at him now that you can do what you want to do? And I think that's the question that's presented to us. Because there's going to come a day where your body is going to be dead.
Yeah.
And at that point, there's only one who can heal you, right? Except you need to secure a relationship with him before that point.
Yes.
You need to want to be healed and to walk away from your rebellion before them, because something far worse than paralysis is on the table there. You know, it's the judgment of God. And so verse 15, it says, the man went away and told the Jews that it was Jesus who healed him. Now, there's a couple things, because this story is inviting you to be like, why does that happen? Like, the Bible doesn't come and say, and this was the motivation for this or that. But it's so suffocating, the religiosity and the, oh, you're going to cut me out if I violate the Sabbath, and now you're coming to me saying I violated the Sabbath. It's not my fault. It's not my fault. It's that guy, the one who made me be able to walk. I'm willing to sell down the river to the Jewish leaders who now want to kill Jesus for this.
Which is,
think how nuts that is. He is stepping in front of our authority, which is really what that's all about. He's stepping in front of our authority and our ability to control and to impose all the standards and to, hey, we want to kill this guy. But this guy has just been healed. He's gotten his ability to walk back. And because of fear of the religiosity, what's he do? That's the guy. Yeah, that's him. It's that guy, Jesus. He just introduced. And so now they want to kill him. Nice. They want to kill Jesus because he's doing these sorts of things. And then Jesus says something that's kind of like, What do you do with that? Like, Jesus answered them and said, my Father is working until now, and I'm working. What does that mean? And so what Jesus is saying here is, hey, you just saw a guy who's been paralyzed for 38 years get up and walk. How do you think that happened? Who do you think healed him?
Yeah.
Is it just me, a guy? You know, you don't think I'm God. But God had to have been the one to heal him. So clearly God is working today.
Yeah.
God worked for 6 days in creation, rested on the seventh, but it's not like on the seventh day, all of a sudden, all of creation just went, yeah, because God stopped sustaining it and ordaining all things. Like, God never stops being in charge. He's always working to bring life out of death and to bring beauty into the world and to sustain all things. And so now the argument he's going to them with is, oh, by the way, my Father, whoa, that's kind of provocative language, because not everybody called God Father, except the Son of God. My Father is working until now, and so I'm working, which is saying he's who?
He's God.
He's God, right? Like, I don't take a break from the work of God on Sabbath. And all of the principles of, you know, you, of course you're going to bring healing. Of course you're going to bring life. Of course you're going to get your, you know, ox out of the ditch and everything else on the Sabbath that would have been acceptable even then. But they're so rigid that Jesus is rebuking them, you know. It is not against the Sabbath to bring people into worship.
Yeah.
Of God, and to bring about the beauty of the gospel and life and flourishing on the Sabbath, right? Like, so it says in verse 18, this was why the Jews were seeking all the more to kill him. Because not only was he breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his own Father, making himself equal with God. And so in this miracle, you find one of these moments where this is when Jesus had a target on his back. Like, this is where they're like, oh, we got to get rid of this guy. He's wrong. He's standing up against our power. He is blasphemous. He's doing all these things. And it's because he healed a guy who, by the way, had more loyalty to these religious leaders than he did to the Lord. Because right as soon as Jesus is like, hey, man, pick your side. Stop this sin. Stop this rebellion. He immediately runs and he's like, that guy, go get him. You know, he's the one who made me break the Sabbath. It's not a good look for the guy that's healed.
And Jesus knew that. And he used it as an opportunity.
That's right. But an incredibly merciful demonstration of Jesus. And we don't know how this guy's story ended.
Yeah.
You know, it's very, very possible that later on this guy sees Jesus and everything he does and is like, oh my gosh, I'm the one who was totally, totally possible. And so you don't know how God ends the story, but here, I love what you find in this.
Yeah.
You know, these are reminders that, you know, we really do have to want to be healed. Why would Jesus ask that question if not? There is a greater thing that each and every person on planet Earth needs to be healed from that's far worse than paralysis.
Yeah.
And Jesus is saying, like, stop running away, stop rebelling, stop sinning, come to me. Like, I can heal you. There's a rebuke against religiosity. There's a, you know, and being super, super rigid and failing to see the beauty of God in all of this. it's just a really, really cool story. And the fact that Jesus is coming and he brings healing to somebody that wasn't chasing after him, and in fact would ultimately cost Jesus some of his safety and popularity, and yet Jesus still extends mercy and grace in that instance to the physical body. It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, that's why the story is so beautiful. It really does just show the sovereignty of God and just even his graciousness to heal.
Amen. And so, like, that's another reason why if God would do this for somebody who, after 38 years of showing up, and he is healed, and yet he still doesn't want the ultimate healing that Jesus has to offer, or at least we don't see evidence of it. Like, how much more, even if God is still saying no or not yet, should we still keep showing up at the throne of grace? You know, we might not be getting carried to the pool, but we have an invitation from the Lord, as the word says, to come boldly before the throne of grace and to do so regularly. You know, the scriptures, when it talks about how God hears our prayers, you know, in the Song of Solomon, the allegory between Christ and his church, it says that God, I mean, if it is an allegory, which I'm pretty certain it is, we need to do an episode on that, that God's heart beats faster and faster with a single glance of your eyes, that his thoughts of you are so numerous, more than the sands of the seashore. Like, our Lord loves to hear from us. It genuinely does thrill the heart of God somehow. He delights in it. And so, even if it's entirely for selfless reasons, you know, okay, God, you don't have to heal me, but I know that my prayer blesses you and you like to hear from your children. You know, I'm calling just to say hi. You know, I want you just to smile. And if I can bring you a blessing, that's a good enough reason to come. And by the way, God, I still have all these needs, but I just want to be with you. Like, I think that kind of heart of prayer is honoring to him. And it takes the burden and the expectation and the fear of disappointment away when you can come with those requests and also just say, I just want to worship you for being a good God. And you know my needs. They're still here. So anyway, we're going to leave it there. We want to thank you for joining us on this episode of The Bible Show. Join us next time as we continue our series in the miracles of Jesus. Thanks for listening to The Bible Show. If you enjoyed this podcast, please remember to like and subscribe and leave a kind review to help us in the world of tech algorithms. Also, feel free to share with a friend. We'll see you next week with another episode of The Bible Show.